Hello and welcome to the Anishinaabe History Podcast. I'm Chris Waite. Mississauga is an Ojibwe Anishinaabe word. In English, it means river with many mouths. The name was voted for in the 1960s to recognize the history of the area that dates back hundreds of years. The official website for the city states the following, quote, "The city of Mississauga, Canada's sixth largest municipality, is located on the traditional territory and treaty lands of the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. This land was purchased from the Mississauga people by the British Crown in 1806 in a legal agreement known as the Treaty 14, or the Head of the Lake Purchase, for the equivalent of only 10 shillings. The purchase made way for non-Indigenous people to settle the area in the early 19th century, and their increased presence made it impossible for the Mississaugas to access the hunting and harvesting lands and waters that they were promised would be shared." End quote. So that treaty was signed between the years of the American War for Independence and the War of 1812. The quote shows that the signing of the treaty prevented Indigenous peoples' access to resources so that British settlers could have access to those same resources. The quote also refers to the promise of sharing the land. It was the sharing of the land and resources that the Indigenous people were negotiating, but it is called a purchase to denote the Euro-capitalist notion of private ownership. The so-called purchasing of land was meant to be inclusive according to Anishinaabe principles, but exclusive according to British principles. And this was a half century before Canada the nation was created. British treaties facilitated the dislocation of Indigenous peoples from traditional territories. The American and Canadian treaties built upon these earlier legal foundations. Hundreds of treaties have been signed across Turtle Island, spanning hundreds of years. Wikipedia states the following regarding the etymology of Mississauga. Quote, "The name Mississauga comes from the Anishinaabe word Missisagging, meaning those at the great river mouth. It is closely related to the Ojibwe word Miswezagging, which means a river with many outlets." End quote. The same article states the following regarding the history of the Anishinaabe migration. Quote, "According to the oral histories of the Anishinaabe, after departing the second stopping place near Niagara Falls, the core Anishinaabe peoples migrated along the shores of Lake Erie to what is now southern Michigan. They became lost, both physically and spiritually. The Mississauga migrated along a northern route by the Credit River to Georgian Bay. These were considered their historic traditional lands on the shores of Lake Superior and northern Lake Huron around the Mississauga River. The Mississauga called for the core Anishinaabe to Midewiwin, meaning return to the path of the good life. The core Anishinaabe peoples formed the Council of Three Fires and migrated from their third stopping place near the present city of Detroit to their fourth stopping place on Manitoulin Island along the eastern shores of Georgian Bay." End quote.
In 2013, we recovered two pieces of a glassy-like substance. Somehow, at around 9,000 years ago, obsidian traveled 4,000 kilometers from the Pacific Northwest to the middle of what is now the Lake Huron Basin. The Alpena-Amberley Ridge is an outcrop underwater that runs obliquely across the Lake Huron Basin between northern Michigan and southern Ontario. Only above water between about 10,000 years ago and about 8,500 years ago.
After the War of 1812, the role of Indigenous peoples in military, economic, and political affairs diminished. It was ultimately supplanted from that of very important trade and military partners to that of superfluous obstacles. The Battle of Seven Oaks occurred in 1816. The Canadian Encyclopedia Online states the following about the battle. Quote, "The Battle of Seven Oaks, or the Victory of the Frog Plain, La Victoire de la Grenouillère, took place 19 June 1816. the battle was a culmination of the Pemmican Wars and the escalating fur trade disputes between the Hudson's Bay Company, HBC, and the Northwest Company, NWC. Pemmican was the food supply that the fur traders depended on to carry out operations. On the day of the battle, a party of about 60 Métis and First Nations men, led by Cuthbert Grant, was heading west of the Forks to deliver pemmican to the NWC canoe brigades on Lake Winnipeg. They were confronted at Seven Oaks by HBC Governor Robert Semple and 28 men, mostly HBC officers and employees. The gunfire and hand-to-hand combat that resulted left Semple and 20 of the HBC party dead. On the Métis side, 16-year-old Joseph Letendre died, and Joseph Trottier was wounded. End quote. 3 years later, and hundreds of kilometers southeast of Lake Winnipeg, the Chippewas of the Thames Treaty had been signed in 1819. That was the same year that the Saginaw Chippewa signed a treaty with the United States. The Chippewa of the Thames Treaty is also known as the Longwoods Treaty. It is numerically number 21. But it is not part of the so-called numbered treaties of Canada. This is because the Chippewa-Thames Treaty was signed with the British, and Canada was not deemed to be its own nation by the British until 1867. So, because Canada didn't technically sign those British treaties, some have argued that Canada, now no longer a mere province but actually its own nation, does not have to abide by the aforementioned treaties. It's a brainwashing, gaslighting, sleight of hand that serves a dual purpose. First, to subvert and undermine Indigenous authority by disregarding earlier treaties, and second, to obfuscate history by teaching that Canada began in 1867 or USA in 1776 without referencing the hundreds of treaties signed with Indigenous nations across Turtle Island. Sometimes people ask me, do treaties still matter? What they're really asking is, do treaties with Indigenous people still matter? Never have I been asked in seriousness, should we dissolve the Canada-USA international border? Or, do provincial boundaries and state lines still matter? The fact that boundaries, borders, and the treaties go hand in hand is lost on most people. We were never appropriately taught it on either side of the medicine line. A lot of people think that the treaties were signed after some sort of conquest. That's not an accurate view of history. The truth is that many wars started after treaties were signed. The Dakota War of 1860 is an example. Likewise, in 1830, the Trail of Tears was implemented many years after the so-called civilized tribes of the eastern United States had already been living peacefully and successfully beside white settlers and farmers. Things like residential schools torturing children, Indian reservations corralling people, and Indian agents controlling economics all came after the treaties were signed. In short, it was not so much of a conquest as it was a betrayal. That's why some Indigenous leaders say, "Honor the treaties." It's a call to revisit the spirit and intent of the peace and friendship treaties that gave rise to the so-called land surrenders. But let's get back to the treaties. North of the Medicine Line, in the year 1820, two treaties were signed by Mississauga Ojibwe people and the British Crown. They are treaties number 22 and 23, and are for the region now known as Mississauga, Ontario. Quote, "The completion of the Adjutant's Treaty of 1818 left the Mississaugas of the Credit with three small reserves at 12 Mile Creek, 16 Mile Creek, and the Credit River. Noting the distress and poverty of the Mississaugas, William Claus, Deputy Superintendent of the Indian Department, met with Mississaugas of the Credit ancestors and proposed the surrender of their remaining lands. Claus promised that the proceeds of the sale would be used to instruct the Mississaugas in the rudiments of the Christian religion and to provide education for their children. In addition, a portion of land consisting of 200 acres located in southeasterly portion of the Credit River Reserve would be set aside as a village site for the Mississaugas. On February 28, 1820, according to the terms of Treaty 22, the Mississaugas acquiesced to the Crown and ceded their lands at 12 and 16 Mile Creeks along with northern and southern portions of the Credit River Reserves. Treaty 23, negotiated later that same day, saw the central portion of the Credit River Reserve, along with its woods and waters, ceded to the Crown for £50. End quote. At least it was for more than just 10 shillings. On the website heritagemississauga.com, the author states the following, quote, "The first treaty I researched was Treaty 19. On October 28, 1818, the Mississauga First Nation ceded the land north of modern-day Eglinton Avenue to the British Crown. This area became known as the New Survey in the Township of Toronto. This area included the villages of Streetsville, Meadowvale, and Malton. The Mississauga Nation kept three portions of land on the Credit River, also known as the Credit Indian Reserve, and the 12-mile and 16-mile creeks, which the Mississauga First Nation had previously been retained in Treaty 13A. 2 years later, the government negotiated for these lands as well. New settlers in the area wanted access to the creeks and river to establish mills. On February 28, 1820, Treaties 22 and 23 were signed. These treaties divided the land in a peculiar fashion. Treaty 22 surrendered all the land from the modern-day Queensway to Lake Ontario, and from approximately the northern entrance of the University of Toronto, Mississauga, Harkis Road, to Eglinton Avenue, within the 1 mile on either side of the Credit River, as well as the lands at the 12 and 16 mile creeks. Treaty 23, signed the same day, surrendered all the land between the portions surrendered in Treaty 22, this being the land on either side of Dundas Street. This left the Mississauga Nation with only 200 acres on the east side of the Credit River. End quote. That same website mentions the relocation of Mississauga people in the year 1847. That would have been 17 years after the Indian Removal Act was enacted in the United States, and 3 years before the Robinson-Superior and Robinson-Huron treaties, which are hundreds of kilometers west of Toronto. Many treaties and much legislation was passed across North America during those years. It was the rise of the United States and the demise of the Indians. In 1867, the province-turned-nation, Canada, would follow suit.
Great Lakes elemental copper is pure enough that it can just be heated up to about 800 or 900 degrees Fahrenheit or something like 400 degrees Celsius and then hammered into shape, almost like you would see a blacksmith do with iron. So some of the oldest evidence that we have for copper being used is a fragment of hammered copper recovered from a fire pit around Lake Superior, and the charcoal from that pit was radiocarbon dated to about 6,800 years ago after it was calibrated, and that's some of the oldest copper forging in the world.
After the War of 1812, the powerful roles that indigenous nations played in North American geopolitics declined. At the same time, European forces across Turtle Island were actually uniting in their singular raison d'être, to have complete control of the continent. That's why treaties such as the Anglo-American Convention of 1818 were signed. It was to band together to get rid of the Indians. And it wouldn't stop until the Americans, the British, and eventually the Canadians reached the West Coast. The Oregon Treaty of 1846 was really just a reaffirmation of the earlier Anglo-American Convention of 1818. My question is, did the United States and Britain and Canada really signed treaties with the multitudinous indigenous peoples across Turtle Island in good faith? I would argue that the US, Britain, and Canada did not sign treaties in good faith because they knew that they had ulterior motives for removing indigenous people from their traditional territories. Their motives included creating a racially segregated, hyper-capitalist resource extraction society. In order for that to happen, the Euro-American enterprises on Turtle Island required the removal and separation of indigenous people from the land and from each other. That's all for today's episode. Stay tuned for more episodes in the future. I'm Chris Waite, and this has been the Anishinaabe History Podcast.